Can you predict what will come in 100 years? Or in 10? Or in the next minute? Some people think they can. They'll predict the shape of the future because they make the future. Because they see beyond the known dimensions of time and space into the unknown, Dimension X. We go ahead now in time.
Cosmic ray bomb they're testing out in the Pacific tonight.
A sparkling crystal diamond, vibrating at a higher frequency so y'all don't have to bother none.
Long run, our ship will make the CR bomb back page stuck.
Come take a listen.
Half the principles in this ship are pure theory.
Let your sensorium be nourished as Matt sheds light on the millennial ecstatics of the day.
So keep your mic open and keep talking. If anything goes wrong, we want to know exactly why.
Welcome to the podcast, dear listener. We have a great episode today. We have Andrew McLuhan. Andrew is the grandson of the famous Marshall McLuhan. And Andrew has continued furthering the work of his grandfather and his father, Eric McLuhan, in promoting media literacy, media studies, media ecology. And we ask the question today, in this episode, why study the media? And I would argue, either study the media or it studies you. Now, dig on that. And as a lot of people know, if you know me, I love Marshall McLuhan. I mark my intellectual life as pre-McLuhan and post-McLuhan. And I argue, if you're not aware of the work of Marshall McLuhan, it would be as if you're living in a world without knowing that evolution exists. Marshall McLuhan is as important as Darwin and Freud. Darwin discovered evolution. Freud discovered the unconscious. And Marshall McLuhan discovered that the medium is the message. And I know that doesn't seem like much right now. You're just now learning about this. But one, when you truly understand that the medium is the message, it creates a perceptual shift in your consciousness that is not unpleasant. And I will never forget when I was working with high school age kids, I educated a group of young people one afternoon regarding the medium is the message. And this young lady, I will never forget, she said, after I explained it to her and she understood it fully, she said, "Oh my goodness, I feel weird right now. I've never felt this way before without taking drugs." And I said, first of all, don't do drugs. And second of all, I said, yes, when you learn radical information, it can make you feel a certain type of way, as the kids say. And I just love that story. Turning on the youth of America to Marshall McLuhan. I am just one humble person. I wish there was an army of people educating the youth of America regarding the importance of Marshall McLuhan. Anyway, let's get to the episode. Thank you.
Very good, man. Very good. I'm so excited to talk to you. I've enjoyed following you on Facebook. I enjoy your poems.
Oh, thank you.
So
yeah, my poems have taken a break for a little while because I used to write a poem every morning during my morning commute, right? That was a thing. But, almost 6 months ago, we moved to where I used to commute to. So now my commute is like 50 feet, which is a little different. So I've kind of let the poetry drop, but I need to get back to it because it's an important thing. I mean, quality is questionable, but just having starting your day off in a poetic frame of mind it sets the tone for the day, you know? And I like to say that it leaks.
Right. I like that.
Okay, you can hear me. Sorry, my video froze.
But I can still hear you.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, so it kind of leaks into my day. And when you start off with poetry, you keep in that kind of frame of mind. I mean, I like to think that poetry itself is not so much about words and rhyming and meter, but how you experience and relate to the world. The poem itself is just kind of an excuse for that. And that's why, over 2 years ago, I hadn't written any poetry for a long time. And I got to thinking, am I still a poet? And that's what I came up with. That it's not so much about writing, it's how you experience, encounter, and respond to the world. And so that made me feel a bit better about it. And I started writing poetry again, such as it is,
Nice. Yeah, I dig it. I've been getting back into writing poetry myself. Are you familiar with Alejandro Jodorowsky, the filmmaker?
No.
Oh, definitely. He's a must see. He was a avant-garde filmmaker in the 60s, but then he got into shamanic psychotherapy.
Fascinating. Okay.
And one of the things he says is that if you write poetry 30 minutes a day, it purifies your ego. So it fits into what you're saying. I've been trying to do that. Purify.
Yeah, I just suggest that it's not even so much about writing. Writing is just the excuse to get into the poetic state, And the poetic state is almost it's almost a shamanic state because it's a liminal state. It's a place you go that's kind of neither here nor there, but somewhere in between where you're it's an experiential state where you're searching for a different encounter with whatever we call as reality, where you're trying to take things in and you're trying to put things out. And I think there's a relation there actually to shamanism, if that's what shamanism is. But what on earth is shamanic psychotherapy?
Oh, wow. That's a whole nother podcast. He works a lot with making people's dreams concrete. So he gives people these sort of rituals to perform based on their dreams to sort of embody the learning of the dream in the real world. Fascinating guy. Cool. Fascinating guy, Andrew, but not as fascinating as Marshall McLuhan. So let's just get right into it. My hope for our talk today is to explain to people why Marshall McLuhan is important, why you need to know about Marshall McLuhan. My friends and family are tired of me talking about him. I would imagine I have not done the best of jobs explaining why it's important, but you, I believe, do a good job. with that.
Thank you.
Can you
hear this? You know, I think I get away with a lot because my name is McLuhan, you know, so it's kind of an excuse for why I might talk about it a lot. In fact, my name is Andrew Ellis Marshall McLuhan. My parents did that to me. So, you know, I kind of have two identities. I have Andrew Ellis. Ellis is my mother's maiden name, Andrew Ellis, and then Marshall McLuhan. Of course, my grandfather, Marshall, his name was Herbert Marshall McLuhan. Marshall is actually a traditional surname, and it's common in our family for generations to give the firstborn, pardon me, the Marshall in the name. So that's how, and my firstborn son, I have two, is Ezra Dayton Marshall McLuhan. So I kept the tradition and he can do what he wants with it. But it is hard to explain. And I think I became clear on it, or more clear anyway, a couple of years ago when the first time, half a dozen years ago, I thought I would do a workshop on the medium is the message. You know, what does that mean? And I spent a couple of months, evenings, really poring over that first chapter of Understanding Media, breaking down every time he used the word medium, every time he said the medium is the message, and the context and you know, use and all this. And I ended up delivering this 2-hour workshop, which, oh my God, tedious. But I was trying to get a friend of mine who's a local businessman and advertising marketing guy. I was like, hey, you should come check out my workshop and, you know, get your team on board too. They said, okay, yeah, but, you know, why? And I was like, why? Because to me, he was asking, why study media? And I mean, the answers are obvious, I thought. But yet when I was put on the spot to answer that question, why study media, I couldn't, because as obvious as it is, as much as you and I know it intuitively, it's really difficult to explain. And I think that's a sort of truism with a lot of things that are seemingly simple, but when you try to actually articulate them, no matter how much you know it in your bones, you know, the words sometimes escape. So I actually gave a presentation a couple of years ago at the Media Ecology Association on why study media. And the short answer is because the medium is the message. But to get to that answer, you have to understand what the word medium means. And when Marshall used the term, and when we use it in McLuhan studies and media studies, we're not talking about a piece of technology like a smartphone. We're talking about the effects. We're talking about the environment that comes into being with this major piece of technology. So we're not talking about this piece of hardware, which is a smartphone. What we're talking about is we're talking about the internet. We're talking about networks. We're talking about education, technology, raw materials. We're talking about the reorganization of daily life. We're talking about what it means to relate to each other when everybody has one of these and we don't have conversations. We're talking about kids who are on devices all the time. All these things build out an ecosystem in an environment of interrelated parts, which becomes so enmeshed with us that to take this away would be almost a disaster. You know, we wouldn't know how to cope with it. That environment is what's meant by the word medium, you know, like a growing medium, a milieu, a substance in which things grow. And it is because of that medium of effects, of services and disservices, of social and psychological and sensorial effects, that medium is the message of the technology, the true meaning, the true effect, much more than any little thing you or I might do with it. That's why the medium is the message. And that's why we need to study media, because these environments quickly become such a part of our lives that if we want to have any control over what happens as a result of them, we need to study them. Just like we study the natural environment, you know, and we take note of pollution and things like that, because everybody has to breathe. And you know, we can, to an extent, control environments. We created things like the FDA and the Environmental Protection Act to control companies and major polluters to make sure that, you know, they behave in a certain manner, or we try to anyway. We're still in a global warming mess, but, you know, it seems a very difficult thing that people don't want to accept just how big the consequences of something like this are. It's really easy for us to understand that, you know, some major corporation has a factory on a river and it pollutes into the river and it poisons our wells and it kills fish or birds can't lay eggs and things like that. But we have a much harder time grappling with the consequences of our innovations and our inventions because the effects are so subtle. I mean, they're not subtle when you start to look at them, but there's something weird about human perception and, you know, us wanting to deny the effects of these things. Instead, we concentrate on the content and what we can do with them. But the main thrust of McLuhan work really is this kind of media ecology where it's not a spectator sport. You know, this is not really for theories and for academic conferences and writing papers and books. It's, you know, if all we did was go to conferences and write papers about the pollution problem and global warming, nothing would ever get done. You know, media ecology needs to be about action. And this was what Marshall was up to, really with his work. What it all underpins is that he was trying to get us to confront the effects of technologies, not just so that we're awake to them, but so that we actually did something. You know, he said, I refuse to just sit by and let the juggernaut roll over me. You know, he was a man of action. And a lot of that gets lost in the sort of hype about McLuhan and, you know, this pop culture figure in the 60s who said a lot of groovy things and wow, he was right, you know, but it's not the point of, that's not the point at all. The point is to do something about it. So that's why hopefully we have conversations like this and people think about it.
Right, right. So once we understand the effects, sort of are aware of the new environment these mediums have put us in, like the fish who doesn't know they're in water, once we are aware, hey, we're in water, this is the effect the water has on us, now we can do something about the positive effects. Is that a way you would say?
I mean, hopefully, you know, presumably. Marshall didn't expect to get that far in his lifetime, and indeed he didn't. He said a few places things like, you know, I don't presume to prescribe. You know, I don't know what to do about the situation. First, we've got to look at it and to explore it and to understand it. And not until we understand things can we really decide on a course of action. He did have some definite ideas on how we might do that. One thing he studied very closely was the interaction of different technologies on each other. And he had an idea for one way to control our technological environments by balancing the different technologies that we use. So, you know, the way he put it, back in the 60s, which was whatever, kind of dated, but he's like, you know, if things are too hot over in this area, you know, turn down the hot media and turn up the cool media and, you know, balance the effects that you want by the different technologies that you use, which have these different effects, which gets really, really complicated and kind of hurts the head to think about. Personally, I think we can do better than that. I think that we can make smarter design choices and, you know, get ahead of the effects that way. Because currently, most of the communications technologies, anyway, that we develop, apps like Facebook and Twitter and all the social media, these things are generally designed to control attention, to capture and keep attention. And the effects of that are very serious psychologically and with our senses, you know. We're looking at the fallout from that. But instead of optimizing for attention, we might optimize for other effects. You know, different technologies, it's sometimes, you have to understand that what Marshall considered a medium that is a technology was a very, very wide definition. It wasn't just smartphones or computers. It wasn't just communications technologies, but any human innovation can have serious effects, from a pencil to even styles, like, you know, styles of music, like rap music and things like that. All of these things are human technologies and innovations, and they all have very similar levels of effects, which need to be studied. So it's about a lot more than just communication, but it's about innovation. And I think that's an important distinction.
Good stuff, Andrew. Very good stuff. Now, to talk about dealing with the effects of these mediums. So one of my problems with media ecology, or talking about the effects of the media, the effect of technology, is that when we talk about it, it's only in terms of the negative effects it's having on us. This new documentary on Netflix, The Social Dilemma, it's a very good documentary. Highly recommend it. Little creepy, I think, when they talk about truth versus fake news. They're basically trying to tell me what is truth and what isn't. I balk at that, but I really liked what they were talking about. But it just stops at this is negative. This is all negative. What this is doing to us is negative. And that worries me, that we're missing the positive effects. And that was something Marshall McLuhan was big on, talking about the positive effects. Every new technology has positive and negative effects. Mm-hmm. What say you on this?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's kind of swinging to the opposite end of the pendulum. You know, they're the boosters, you know, the media literacy people, and Media Literacy Week is coming up, who are all about empowering yourself through technology, you know, using these things for good, and harnessing the positive power of technologies. Teach kids to code so that they can take control. And it's like, you know, that's one thing. And then this other documentary, which actually I'm not sure if it was you or somebody else recently recommended me to check that out, so I'm going to try and do that. Then there's the other people who come off a little as conspiracy tinfoil hat type people on the other end, who are all about the Luddites, right? Who are like, smash the machine, and you know, this stuff is destroying us. And Marshall's take was, Marshall's take was neither here nor there. It was a neutral position, because he felt you couldn't take a pro or con position on these things until you understood them. And neither of those camps seemed to understand them. In fact, once you make up your mind whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, it kind of turns off a lot of your ability to look at how something actually operates, its nature, and the effects that it has. So he took a sort of amoral, not immoral, stance, because he said, you know, the moral point of view is a poor insight for, is a poor excuse for insight or an understanding. So there's that. Personally, he was a book lover and a fan of, you know, the 18th, 19th century, especially in literature, less so television and things, but he tried as much as he could to step away from those things when he was studying technology, and to encounter and look at things on their terms. And he was certainly happy to talk about the positive aspects of technologies. For instance, he was early on, especially, he was very positive about the prospects for television in education, he felt that the television was a very great tool for teaching. Also, you know, things like telephone, I find myself recommending for people. I do a bunch of these interviews, and sometimes I do them by Zoom, and sometimes I do them just by audio, by telephone line. And I find that's an interesting thing. It makes for a different experience. I was having a conversation recently with a medical doctor in Oregon, and he had noticed in his practice during the COVID time, people weren't seeing patients. So people were moving more and more online to meetings like this to talk to their patients. And he was cautious about this and the effect that it might have. I suggested to him, well, why don't you try doing a lot of them just by telephone? And he hadn't considered that, but when you're just on telephone, you reduce the noise to a certain extent, and you concentrate just on your voice and your hearing. And that provides a different space for discussion, more intimate in some respects. I would be the last one to write off, any technology as simply a good or a bad thing. You know, there's positive and negatives to be had, and you have to choose which outweighs the other in your own use. Where I think it is of most concern is with children. And I was actually doing some reading yesterday. Because I'm getting ready to teach this 12-part course on understanding media, I've been going back in our files to 1965, well, between 1960 and 1965-64, when Marshall was working on what became Understanding Media. And he mentioned a composer, a German composer, music teacher, who only took students from age 3 to 5, because he felt they were best suited to learn music before they learned to read and write. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting thing. You'll notice that, it's a truism that it's a lot easier to pick up a language when you're age 3 to 5, because your brain is like a sponge. You haven't yet taken on all these things and become set in your ways. And because of that, I'm very wary about my own children and their exposure to screens, essentially. It's impossible to avoid all screens in this day and age. And indeed, in school, they're given iPads and stuff to play around with. And that is what it is. I'm not about to buck the system too much about that. And I don't want to come off as a conspiracy nut. And you can't convince people of positions that they're already firmly embedded in. But it's very important to me to have my children's brains wired to literacy before wired to their computer. And that's because the literate sensibility as formed with the alphabet and with words is much different than the sensibility formed by our technological environment today. Marshall did a lot of work on this in his book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, The Making of Typographic Man, where, the word on the page has a much different effect than the word on the screen, for example. And my own father took this approach with us as children and really limited our TV time. And if we wanted to watch TV, we had to read first for an equal or greater amount of time. And this was because, coming back to the medium is the message, one of the things that media do is they affect our senses. So when we spend any amount of time immersed in screen culture, by affecting one sense, our senses work in a balance, in an equilibrium. And when you affect one sense, you affect them all. You hear about blind people who become blind later in life, and very quickly, without their visual sense, their other senses heighten. They talk about how their hearing improves or becomes more acute. and their senses of touch become more acute. They use canes because they're much more sensitive. Well, this happens not just when you're blind, but with every technology that you encounter. When you affect or heighten one sense, it has a corresponding effect with all your other senses. And we're noticing this from the last several months and people spending even more on time. You'll notice that people's nerves are really raw and people are on edge and anxious, and mental health is a big concern. Correlation isn't causation, but it's also not causation too. It's very wise to be conscious of the effects of our technologies and take a hand in your personal life. There's a couple major groups of the effects of technologies. There's the personal and there's the social. So the sensorial effects, the way technologies affect your senses, are very personal and individual. And then there's the societal effects, where the smartphone reorganizes the way we interrelate with each other. For the personal consequences, we have a bit more of a hand. We can choose to engage less in screen time and engage more in print time or radio time or just time in nature without any, intermediation from technologies. But the societal effects are a different thing, and that requires a lot of cooperation, and that kind of change can only come from the top down, really. That's why I'm hoping, and I'm seeing it actually, more and more people are starting to understand that technologies affect us in deeply and significant ways. And the more and more they understand that, and the more fed up they get, the more chance we have that government will take notice and we'll start to get any kind of regulation. Sorry, well, Matt, I'm rambling.
No, I dig it. It's good. So you had, your father, for the listener, Andrew's father was a media theorist as well, and do want to get to some of his work before we wrap up. So you're saying literature is, reading is better than watching a screen. Is that what you're saying?
Better depends on, a context.
Well, the reason I asked that is because I was trying to set you up, Andrew.
I noticed.
Because anytime we're talking about technology, it seems that people, their brains just go to reading is better. And I'm right. Afraid that they hear you talking about, okay, his father had them read to before they watched the television. I'm afraid people would take that as reading is better. Reading a book is better than watching TV. And that's a big pet peeve of mine. And yep. I'm a psychotherapist and I've worked many years with young people. And they will say to me, I don't like to learn because I don't read books. I said, No. Learning is not just in books, but people think that learning only exists in the book.
Indeed. Yeah, I kind of suspected you were going there. It's not that when people say it's better, they're acknowledging that there's a difference, that one has a different effect than the other. But that's a more sophisticated, a deeper analysis. So it's easier just to say one is better than the other. But it's like, better for what, right? It depends on what outcome you're looking for. Who do you want to be, And again, it comes down to societal too. So, we're no longer in a society that is governed by print. It's not that people can't read. That's not the point. The point is that books don't make the world go round anymore, and so that's just the society that we live in. Better or worse, is really subjective. Often people are talking about a preference. Often people are talking about aesthetics, and often they're talking it's a kind of conceit. And I think that's maybe what rubs you the wrong way. It's not that you can't learn other ways at all. I think a lot of people have an intuitive understanding why they prefer one technology like printed page over the screen, but they don't necessarily have that in the front of their consciousness to be able to explain why. They just know they prefer one thing. And it's like any art too, you know, it's like, rap music is better than country music. Well, it's not better. It's, you know, a preference, a style choice to a man, to a great degree. But, reading and writing, with a pencil or pen and paper, versus typing, you know, this is a pet peeve of mine. A lot of people, I follow some people on Twitter who talk about writing all the time, and these people don't write a damn thing. You know, they make notes on their iPhone and they type on their computer. And as Truman Capote said about Jack Kerouac's work, that's not writing, that's typing, you know? And what he was getting at there is that there's a large qualitative difference between writing and typing. For one thing, you can type, if you're any good, you can type a lot quicker than you can write, okay? So typing is great for transcription, for example. Like if you're trying to get down somebody's conversation, if you're a student in a class and you wanna get down every word the prof is saying, type on your computer typewriter, you know. Note-taking is a different matter. I mean, there are different methods, there's shorthands and things, but to write a sentence with a pen or pencil on paper versus to type it on a computer takes more or less time. And that right there can make a certain kind of difference in what you're doing. So for myself, when I'm writing a paper or a speech, I like to do drafts by hand because slowing down causes me to think a little more. It slows down my mental process, makes me consider things a little more. Typing, I can go faster. It's more stream of consciousness. It's more speed of thought. It's closer to that. Not necessarily more considered. For myself anyway, speaking on my personal experience, I find there's a qualitative difference between the writing that I do with pen and paper and the typing that I do on a screen. So for example, I always write poetry, almost always write poetry by hand because I find it helps me get into that state where I want to slow things down and consider and search a little more. I do drafts with pen or pencil, pen usually, because I like the speed of a pen. On paper, because I find it's better for my own creativity. But when I want to hammer it words, when I need to get up to a 6,000 word count, I'll take those notes and I'll put them onto a screen and I'll hammer it that way. So is one better than the other? It depends on what you're looking to do. It is a use-based, a content-based decision in some ways. And, you know, I'd be leery just to say that the book is superior. But again, there are affordances, there are services and disservices. One guy, David Perel, who I follow on Twitter, he runs a writing school and he's all about note-taking and things. And I think he believes that a computer or a smartphone or a tablet or something is a superior form of note-taking. But I'm not sure he's familiar with how to use a book for the same purpose. And the book is a very sophisticated technology. You know, it's a very high technology. And I happen to have a lot of experience with it because I've spent a couple of years with my grandfather's library and now with my father's library, and they were very sophisticated in their use of it. For example, this is actually my copy, but just to use as an example, in a book, you have printed pages, you have margins. This is a very interactive technology. You also have fore and end papers with room. And in fact, this edition has notes pages, which is kind of nice. What Marshall and Eric would do when they are reading a text is they would go along, and when they found something of note, they might make a little annotation here, and in the front or in the back, they would note the page and then a reference, like an index point. They had a lot of shorthand, so they were always looking for examples of the medium is the message, or you know, figure and ground and things like that. So they might say page 17, effigy for figure and ground. So when they wanted to refer to it, they could just go to the end note, note where the page is, refer to it, see the text, see their notes on it. Is a very efficient method of storage and retrieval and interaction. And I'm not sure people these days who maybe grew up in the last 30 years are familiar with how to use this tool for that effect. And so they see the shiny new technology and think that this is a superior form when it isn't necessarily, you know. For one thing, the battery on this thing never runs out. You know, I never have to charge it. So there's that. It doesn't require Wi-Fi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now look, I'm not talking down computers because I use them a lot. I'm not talking down the smartphone because I lean on it very heavily, especially these days. It's great for a lot of things, but I also value other technologies, and I try to be conscious about what I use, how I use it, and the effect that it's having on me generally. I called myself recently a media dietitian. And by that, I was trying to encourage people to think about their technology use and to make a note of it. You know, I think people would be very surprised, just like you're surprised if you start to make a list of all the calories you consume in a day, all the foods you eat in a day, you're very quickly surprised by what's actually on that list. That's the same with our technologies. You know, make a note of every time you look at your phone, make a note of every time you might write a note on a piece of paper, every time the radio's on, every time you see an advertisement, you know, all these things. It quickly adds up and can be a little bit shocking. We live in the world that we live in. So, you know, you only have so many choices to make. A lot of them are made for you, but that doesn't mean that you can't have some input too. And so when I talk about a media diet, I try and reaffirm agency, because we do have a lot of agency.
I really like that notion of a media dietitian. And I want to point out, just for the listener, because I know where people's brains are going, this is all really good stuff. So you're saying social media is bad. I'll stop using social media. Great talk. No, no, no. Social media would just be one component of your diet. Say it's vitamin C. You wouldn't eliminate vitamin C and only focus on vitamin D. You would have a balance. I think we're talking here about balance. And yeah. I think you bring up a really good point about the different ways to create poetry with the different mediums. And one thing Marshall said was that the typewriter was the medium for poetry. I think he was mainly talking about, I guess, Pound or maybe E.E. Cummings, but I took that and I started writing a series of poems on an old typewriter.
Cool.
And I really think you see the different effects of mediums when you write poetry versus, so I now write by hand, I write some on the computer, and it's just interesting to see the different effects.
Yeah, you know, I would love to write a manuscript. I would love to write a book by hand. I don't know, very few people do that anymore. I just think it would be a really interesting exercise. The thing is, it takes a long time to write, you know, a page versus type a page. So, you know, it's a lot more efficient to type. However, there are differences. Look, social media, I'm a pretty heavy social media user. I have Facebook accounts, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. I have personal accounts, and then I have accounts for the McLuhan Institute on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube. Look, these are tools at our disposal that we can use to get things done in this world. It's how you and I know each other. It's how I know a lot of the people that I know. It's about networking. It's about making connections. It's about community. It's about exploration and sharing of ideas. It's about all these things. It's also about attention span. It's about identity and who the hell am I? And what is my body when I don't use it most of the time, when my consciousness is outside of me, it's there. I'm in Turkey right now, and I'm also in somebody's ear and God knows where in the future. And here I am in the past, but I'm also in the future. You know, this rips up time and space and rips up ourselves. And who are we? What does that mean to ourselves? My nerves are raw, just like everybody else's.
I love to rip up time and space. I love ripping up time and space.
Well, that's what you're doing, whether you know it or not. You know, it's a fact. You're here, you're there, you're everywhere. You know, here comes everybody. It's you, Matt.
Here comes everybody. Yes.
Right? Had to get a Finnegan's Wake reference in there. But so the point is to be conscious of not only what you're using a technology for, but what the technology is doing to you and by extension to society and to other people. And the fact is that it's doing a lot that we're not paying attention to. But we are, I think, increasingly more and more, pardon me, paying attention to them. And it's a bit of a blessing and a curse, if you want to put it in those terms, about electric technologies. Marshall put it this way when he paraphrased somebody or brought up somebody who said that if they only raised the bathwater half a degree every hour, we wouldn't know when to scream. Okay. Mm-hmm. The point being that when change happens really gradually, it's really hard to notice it. When change happens instantaneously, when you're dropped into a boiling pot of water, you notice that. When the temperature just slowly raises, you get accustomed to it and it's just what it is. With electric technologies, starting with telegraph, moving through radio into where we are today, we're being dropped in the boiling pot of water every time we turn around. And it's hard not to take note of that. It's becoming increasingly hard to not take note of that. And that's a good and a bad thing. It means that we have some chance of understanding our situation, but it also means that we're doing more and more things to ourselves, harm or good, you know, to be seen. But it also means that people, when I explain or try and explain what the medium is the message means, I can explain it pretty quickly to people today in, you know, 5, 10, 20 minutes if I want to go really deep into it. And I can talk to a group of people, and at the end it's like, yeah, obviously the medium is the message. Obviously the environment that's created by these technologies is of a supreme importance compared to the minor things we might be doing with them. This little conversation we have is a very, if you'll forgive me, very little significance compared to what Zoom conversation has meant in the last 6 months. You know, it's the totality of effects more than just the little bits and pieces, as much as we like to tell ourselves that what we're doing is very consequential and important. It's really in the concretization that the effects happen. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when Marshall first said the medium is the message in 1958, 59, 60, people were like, what are you talking about? The message is the message. And, you know, what does that even mean? That makes no sense. He spent 40 years explaining to people what the medium is, the message means, hundreds and hundreds of different times in different ways. Now I can say it and it's obvious. And that to me is a testament to the evolution of people's thinking and understanding. And that gives me hope because it tells me that we're coming along as a society and we're getting closer and closer to a place where we'll demand more agency and especially intervention by governments on our collective behalf.
I want to say one thing, get on my soapbox a little bit before we, I want to pivot to Finnegan's Wake and your father's work, because I know he studied Finnegan's Wake. And I also wanted to maybe us do a tetrad. I know you had about an hour you could do. If you do not talk about Marshall McLuhan, I don't want to hear what you have to say about technology or its effects. Just saying that, I don't care what you think. If you went to Harvard or wherever the hell you went, you're not smart, you're not interesting. It makes no sense, it's of no relevance, unless you're talking about Marshall McLuhan. I'm sorry, Andrew, I get a little worked up. But let's, Finnegan's Wake, you said, here comes everybody. That is a phrase from Finnegan's Wake. I would argue we are in that environment now where here comes everybody. Here came everybody. Everybody meaning everybody on social media, everybody posting their videos on YouTube. It's everybody against everybody, maybe. Andrew, so any thoughts on Finnegan's Wake and tying it into your father's work in studying Finnegan's Wake?
I mean, you're more of an expert on Finnegan's Wake than I am, really. I haven't studied it too deeply. I don't have a lot of regrets, but I wish I'd had more time with my dad talking about Finnegan's Wake and learning from him about it. But I know enough to sound like I know what I'm talking about, or to be a little bit dangerous anyway. Finnegan's Wake, it's interesting. You know, there are a couple different types of McLuhan people, right? They're the people who pay attention to what Marshall had to say about technology, but don't like to acknowledge the literary side of things. And then there are people who acknowledge the literary roots of Marshall McLuhan, which are crucial to understanding what he did, because Marshall McLuhan was an English professor who came to study the effects of technology and culture directly from his studies in literature. You can't have one without the other. And that's uncomfortable to people because it doesn't make any sense. It really boggles the mind, but there you have it. The reasons for that are probably, you know, another podcast, but it boils down to Marshall McLuhan and Eric came out with this book called Laws of Media, the New Science. But before that, Marshall understood that our technologies behave as languages, as words. And that's why his training in understanding languages and words come in handy, because he basically took the tools he learned and developed for understanding language, literature, poetry, and applied them onto technology and culture. And it worked, much to everybody's surprise. Finnegan's Wake, it further bothers people how much he drew from Finnegan's Wake, because Marshall used a lot of different authors, a lot of different works in his own work. The one person he quotes more than anybody else is James Joyce. And the one work of James Joyce's, which he quotes more than any other else, is Finnegan's Wake, which bothers a lot of people because Finnegan's Wake is a very difficult book to encounter. It's not a book like any other book. But while it might seem like gibberish to people, it's very deliberate. As was Marshall. Marshall was very deliberate. the reason why Marshall McLuhan liked to call his work applied choice, and I've gone into that in other places, but he considered Finnegan's Wake a training manual. And this comes back to the medium as the message, because it's the effect of the writing and the style of James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, which is important. Marshall had a view for the arts that what the arts do is they help train our perception and our sensibility, and they point out to us things that are happening in our society, oftentimes not directly, but by implication. And Finnegan's Wake operates on that level. Just like I said, how we talked about poetry leaking into your life, Finnegan's Wake is the same sort of thing. You know, it's full of wordplay and experimentation and puns, multi-level meanings. And when you start to pay a lot of attention to that and you spend a lot of time in Finnegan's Wake, it leaks out into your life and affects the way that you encounter all language. And same with Marshall McLuhan's work. When you pay attention to what he's doing, it starts to leak out into how you encounter technology and culture and what people do. So my father, Eric McLuhan, wrote his PhD thesis on Finnegan's Wake. It was originally titled Manipian Thunder at Finnegan's Wake. When it was published as a book, it was The Role of Thunder in Finnegan's Wake, role being a pun on a role of thunder, and role as in the use or the what the thunder was used for. Thunder refers to, as you know, Matt, the 10 words in Finnegan's Wake that are 100 letters long, one of them being 101 letters long, which Marshall and Eric didn't know what to do with at first, but discovered that they weren't merely gibberish, but very careful constructions. And in my dad's PhD thesis, he goes into just what that meant. But there were dozens and dozens and dozens of languages all rolled in into one word, describing the effects of technology, specific technologies. So there's a lot to unpack from all that. I've enjoyed, you do readings of Finnegan's Wake, and I like listening to you read the Wake. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I've really gotten into that. And the more I do it, the more sort of meaning it takes on. And we're talking here about how to deal with the negative effects of media. And I truly believe literally reading Finnegan's Wake can be an antidote to some of these negative effects. And I think having young people read Finnegan's Wake, just read it, just look at it, just talk about it, can really, really help them.
I have a large part of what I do with the McLuhan Institute, a large part of the reason I created the McLuhan Institute a couple years ago is for educational purposes, to bring McLuhan studies to the world. Because there's really nobody else doing it. And if I didn't do it, nobody else was going to. One of the things I'm doing is I'm about to launch this 12-week course on understanding media called UMI, Understanding Media Intensive, through this San Francisco tech, culture tech institution, gray area. But I have this idea for a degree in McLuhan studies, which would be very involving. But one thing that would be part of it is a Finnegan's Wake reading class. And it's mandatory. Everybody would have to take it. And basically, all you do is just get together and read Finnegan's Wake and discuss it with each other. No tests or anything. It's just reading, because it's about getting you into certain frame of mind, getting you into exploring language and exploring meaning, and ambiguity, and the effect that they'll have on you. Similarly, with the course that I'm teaching, I'm recommending, there's a reason why I'm doing it in 12 classes over 12 weeks. And I'm also recommending that people pick up a physical copy of the book and spend time with the printed word on the page, because it's to to force you to slow down and to encounter things in a specific way, and to let that work on your sensibility instead of having this work on your sensibility. And I'm hoping to do a sort of exit interview with people when the 12 weeks are up to find out if they feel that it's had, or what impact it has had on their lives, if any. Can they notice any difference after spending more time with text than they might otherwise? The class is an experiment in many ways, and I really hope that people meet it on its own terms, and will play along.
Very cool, very cool. Well, Andrew, you're doing the Lord's work. That is clear.
Thank you.
I want to, if you're down with it, I want to talk about tetrads, because this is where the laws of media come in. And your father, that was a big aspect of his work, the laws of media. So can you speak about the laws of media? And then I thought it would be fun to do a tetrad. I do think tetrads are another way to combat the negative effects of technology. If you're aware of a tetrad, you're going to be sort of, it's like a sort of armor, I think.
Okay. It's a large discussion again, but basically what happened is Understanding Media came out in 1964. It actually grew out of an earlier work in 1960. Coming up to 10 years later, Marshall was approached by the publisher to do a 10th anniversary edition of Understanding Media. And this was in about 1970. And Marshall, my dad was working with Marshall by then, since the mid-late 60s. And Marshall thought this was a great opportunity to address some of the criticisms that Understanding Media faced, primarily that this was not a scientific work, that it's all great and whatever, but it's not science, it's not scientific. So Marshall decided this was an opportunity to try and explore if there was any way to approach understanding media, understanding technology and its effects, scientifically, that is, systematically, on a scientific basis. So after a little bit of searching around to find out what that might actually mean, they decided to look for some statements, things that we can say about technologies that are true across the board. That is, what technologies do. What are, just as we have laws of physics, laws of energy, what would the laws of media be? So they started to look at that, and their criteria was that it had to be, in order for it to be a law, it had to apply in all cases. So the first thing they did was they had to, they set the criteria that what they were studying was any human innovation whatsoever, not just communications technologies, but anytime people create a tool to do something to enhance some function of ours. Long story short, they ended up finding four things that all technologies do in every case: old technologies, new technologies, applicable across the board. And that is that every technology enhances some basic human function or sense or ability, speeds it up. It obsolesces another, which means not that it kills the older technology, but that it takes over for what the technology used to do. It takes over that function, and the old technology, while not necessarily dying, takes on a different role. So enhance, obsolesce, reverse is another part of the tetrad. And they found that every technology, when you push its use far enough, it tends to reverse its characteristics. So that when you have something like a highway, which was created to enhance the flow of traffic and speed up commuting and getting from A to B, when you put too many cars on the road, you slow things down and you even create a traffic jam, which is the reverse of, the function of the highway. and Retrieve, they found that every technology brings back something, some earlier technology from the past. Now, there are a few things to note. One is that there's no order. Like, it's not first it enhances, then it obsolesces, then it reverses, then it retrieves. All these aspects are simultaneous and present at the same time in any technology. So that's important to know. So you don't have to necessarily create a tetrad starting with enhance, starting with obsolesce. Another thing is that there's a proportion, a harmony among these parts they discovered. There's a relation of A to B as C is to D. That's helpful for a few ways, for a few reasons. Enhances to obsolesce as reverses to retrieve. This helps because it can be very difficult to get at all parts of the tetrad. And it's important to know that there's no one right answer for them. In fact, there might be a lot of answers, you know, especially with technologies that we come in with today. That's like, what does a smartphone enhance? Well, shoot, it enhances a hell of a lot of things. You know, it takes over for a lot of things. It's a telephone, it's a camera, it's a communications device, it's a note taker, it's a whatever. You know, there's a lot of things that it does, that it takes over from. So there's not just one right answer. The harmony part, the balance, helps when you're trying to figure out all the parts of the tetrad and you're stuck. Myself, I get stuck a lot on retrieve. What does this technology bring back from the past? Because while the other parts of the tetrad are a bit of a mental exercise, you can imagine things. Retrieval, you have to know a lot of things. In order to know what's being brought up from the past, you have to know a lot about the past, and especially technology. We have a whole field developed to that these days called media archaeology, which is very helpful. Yeah, it's called media archaeology, and they tend to look at, you know, past technologies, which is really helpful for the retrieval quadrant of the tetrad. You can't know what's being brought back if you don't know what's the past in technology. So the thing to note about the tetrad is it's very serious, you know, but it's also fun. It's about exploration and about play. And that's the best way to explore, is to have fun with things. Another reason Finnegan's Wake comes in. So I think that's sort of the basics on the tetrad. Another thing is that it's a tool, okay? It's meant to be used to explore the effects of technologies. The great thing about it is that it can be used to look at the effects of older technologies. It can be used to look at the effects of technologies today. It can be used to think about what the technologies might be, the effects might be of a technology we're developing. That's where I think it has the most potential in use. Especially if we ever want to get ahead of the effects of technologies, a great way to start is by trying to understand them before we release them into society. And the tetrad can help there because technologies do a lot more than four things, but because we know they will do these four things, it gives us a place to start. And oftentimes in any endeavor, starting is the hard part, you know. The hardest thing to confront is the blank page. Once you get things rolling, things fall into place. So the tetrad gives you four. You know that any technology is going to do at least these four things. And once you get started, it's a lot easier to learn things. So the other thing about a tool is that don't expect to be an expert the first day. You know, if you've never built a piece of furniture, it's going to take you a long time to learn how to hammer in a nail without hitting your thumb and hitting the nail every time. You know, any tool takes a long time of use and familiarity. That's why when I do try and teach people tetrads and I've taught them in schools, I try to encourage teachers to hand out a weekly tetrad assignment. It doesn't matter what you do it on. It doesn't matter if it's fully complete. but at least once a week, try and do a tetrad on something, because that'll get you into looking at technologies these ways. And the more you use it, the easier it is. So keep all those things in mind, and you're off to a good start.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, I'm going to give an example of a tetrad, and I thought to up, we can try to tackle one of these. Okay. Radio. We're going to look at the medium of radio. The human innovation of radio. Radio amplifies music and news via sound. So it radio enhances news and music via sound. Okay? Radio, acoustic radio reverses into visual TV. All right? Radio's spoken word. Radio reduces the prominence of print and visual. So it obsolesces the prominence of print and visual. So what medium do you want to try? Tetrad on. I find it very fun to try to. I thought we could do maybe Zoom itself, since Zoom is now the big technology. It's holding the world together, or podcasting, or anything you want to do.
Yeah, let's go with Zoom video conferencing.
Andrew, you still there?
Yeah, you're breaking in and out, but I'm with you now. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah. I apologize for the
That's okay.
Technical.
Oh, there you are. Let's go with Zoom with video conferencing. That's a good one.
Zoom video conferencing. Okay. What does video conferencing enhance?
So I'll just share that what I do is I've set out a piece of paper here. And I've written video conferencing in the middle, and then I've got EFRO for enhance, flip or reverse, retrieve and obsolesce. I'd really recommend people, so there's Laws of Media, The New Science, which is the big treatment on tetrads. But Eric, my father, also put out a book a couple of years ago called The Lost Tetrads of Marshall McLuhan. And I think that's a much more approachable way into tetrads. It's very helpful. Laws of Media was really written for an academic audience. Lost Tetrads written more for a popular audience. So I start this way so that I have the technology in the middle, and I can build out from that. All right. Enhance, video conferencing obviously enhances person-to-person communication, P2P.com. Enhances also social communication, conferencing, obviously.
It enhances business function, can we say that?
Business. Yeah, business, learning. Often the most obvious aspect of a technology is what we use it for. So necessarily the amplify, the enhance quadrant is usually the easiest to fill out because, well, what do we do with it is what it enhances, basically. The opposite that, what it obsolesces is kind of the flip side of what it enhances. So if it enhances, you know, for instance, school or class, school class learning. It also obsolesces the classroom. It takes over from the classroom. Because the classroom was obsolesced by coronavirus and the reaction to it, you know, video conferencing has gone through the roof. So let's say the classroom, the boardroom even.
The office, you know, I'm thinking of the sitcom, The Office. It's all about that environment. Zooms obsolesces that.
Oh my gosh. That would be actually a hilarious concept for a reboot of The Office, is, you know, the Corona Office where everybody's working from home.
I'm going to write that down.
Right.
I do write scripts. So if you see that, we'll work out the legalities of that later, who owns that.
Oh yeah, whatever. You'd be joining a rich tradition.
I had some friends actually who did Zoom plays during coronavirus, which I thought was a really unique use of Zoom. So they made a whole play just on, you know, Zoom.
Cool. So what do you think about Retrieve for video conferencing?
What does it retrieve? Well, for during Corona, it retrieved some semblance of real life.
Okay. Yeah. This is why the retrieval is often a difficult thing. But the great thing about the Tetrad is, A, you know that it's simultaneous, so you don't have to go in order. And my dad, when he was making Tetrad, would often let things sit, come back to it later, come back to it tomorrow, let it work away in your mind. Maybe things come up. Another thing is, when you know, if you have three of the four parts and you know there's a relation, a proportion between the parts, that A is to B as C is to D. If you don't have C, but you know A is to B, you can help find C by understanding the relationship between the top is going to rhyme with the relationship at the bottom. So where is a rhyme between C and D? That might help you find the missing part. So what about reverse with flip? If you take video conferencing too far, what happens?
When it's pushed to its extreme, it flips into
I think you end up with a lot of social effects, like not knowing how to conduct meetings in real life. Conference, for example, I think the conference is forever changed because of these last few months, because so many conferences can be held online that I think people will A, have less pressure to attend a conference in person, but B, there'll be less financial support for people. Why would your university give you a conference budget for travel and stuff when you don't need to travel there, you know?
So when push was extreme, it the death of conferences, so to say, the death of academic conferences, the death.
Well, death, rebirth, renewal, you know, these are hand in hand things. Academic conferences, aren't going to be over, but they're going to be different, you know, and coming back to the value judgment, when you say death, that implies a certain value judgment, right? Change is a better term to not get too worked up about these things, because there's always going to be conferences, you know, people going to conference.
Yeah, I like to get right? worked up about the death of things, Andrew.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, flips into when pushed to his extreme. This is just sort of anecdotal, but a pornographic show. I don't know if you've heard of this, that there were people bombing Zoom conferences with pornography. And now Zoom, you have to have a passcode. They won't let you use Zoom now without a passcode. So it pushed to its extreme. It goes X-rated.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. One of the aspects of it that works in my favor today is that I live in the country now, and we have a well, and something's going on with the pump, and we have no water pressure, so I wasn't able to shave or have a shower this morning. Of course, you can tell I didn't shave, but you might not be able to tell that I didn't have a shower, but I could use a shower, let's say. That doesn't really factor in to what we're doing.
Well, maybe it will. I've noticed that with Zoom, because I work now all online. I am a therapist and I work all online. It's interesting, me and my wife were doing this before Corona, and it was sort of cutting edge, and other therapists were sort of standoffish about it. But after Corona, every therapist now works online. It's really been interesting in that regard.
Well, sort of invention is the mother of necessity.
Right. But I don't know where this ties in with the tetrad, but I have noticed a less, how can I say this eloquently? You don't have to worry so much about the showers, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You don't know if I have bad breath right now, or, you know.
Yeah, it's positive and negatives. I was late to a conference a while ago because I'd forgotten that I was supposed to be in Poland at 8 in the morning. I thought it was later. Of course, if I had been in Poland, I would have been much more aware of the time zone and the time zone changes. But that's one thing about video conferencing is that there's no jet lag. It obsolesces jet lag, I guess.
Right. Obsolesces personal hygiene.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if we decide to compensate for that.
Right. Man, very cool. Well, we've been at it about an hour. Is there anything else you want to sort of throw out there?
I'll just, if people are interested in this course on understanding media, it starts October 3rd, runs to December 19th. If you go to grayarea.org, you can find it. I should have it up on the McLuhaninstitute.com. That has links to all my social media stuff. And I'm on Patreon too. I don't have any big funding at the moment, so I'm essentially funded by Patreon, and I'd appreciate your support there, patreon.com/McLuhan. Think about your media diet. Thanks for the talk, Matt. It was fun.
Man, I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to go read Finnegan's Wake. I'm inspired. That'll be my diet for tonight. Man, I really enjoyed it. I will send you all the links and everything when we get this up, and we'll go from there.
Perfect. Take care.
All right, man. See ya.